Thank you. Thank you. So let me first say I appreciate that people come in the evening, in the middle of the week, to come to a talk of mine, especially students who already come 4 or 5 times a week for courses to come yet another night for this. I do appreciate it. So normally, I have to give one of these talks every year. Normally, I start 2 months in advance in order to prepare. This year, I started 4 months in advance. It took me 2 months to persuade myself that it was possible to give this talk because the topic is so advanced that it seems very difficult to get into it unless you have sufficient background in both quantum mechanics and computer science. But I promised in the abstract that no knowledge of quantum mechanics would be required. So I promise you there will be no quantum mechanics notation. If there happen to be any physicists in the audience, I apologize. Some of the things I say will only be approximately true, but they will be sufficiently true to get the points across. Okay? So I usually go to the popular press, the trade press, to see what's new on a particular topic. And this was from a few days ago, 22nd of February this year. Quantum computing companies aim to go where no computer has gone before. This is worth reading, actually. A race is on to merge two of the biggest scientific breakthroughs of the 20th century, computer science and quantum physics, to achieve a giant leap in technology called quantum computing. And a host of quantum computing companies are clamoring for a piece of the action. Yeah, the action is venture capital. That's what they're clamoring for. They don't have anything out there to sell yet, so that they're trying to get money from venture capitalists. The idea was proposed by Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman in 1982. Experts envision computers that perform tasks the most powerful supercomputers can't handle. They predict that quantum computers will someday transform drug manufacturing, make artificial intelligence more powerful, lower manufacturing costs, improve defense capabilities, provide better weather modeling, and lower energy costs, among other things. It's a completely different way of computing, a different beast entirely, and the most significant improvement in computation in the last century, said Bob Suter, vice president of IBM's quantum computing program. Of course, he has to be a champion for his own program. It offers the opportunity to rethink so much of what we've achieved. Quantum computing companies face a big challenge. Their computers operate in the bizarre and counterintuitive world of quantum mechanics, where subatomic particles like electrons and photons can seemingly exist in multiple states. And indeed, they do. So before this talk yesterday, I went to Google, and I did a search for quantum computers will. And you know, this is what Google does. It auto-completes. It gives you some selections of popular searches. Will never work. There are indeed people who claim that quantum computers will never work. They will destroy Bitcoin. They may very well destroy Bitcoin, but of course they have to work in order to do that. Will change everything. Break the encryption. Fail. Change the world. Create jobs. Not sure about that. Okay? Anyway. So you can see that there is a widespread in opinions about quantum computing. Now, why did I choose myself to give this talk? It's not actually because of the credentials that Paul mentioned. I started out life in physics. My father was head of the physics department at New York University, and my toddler years were spent in his laboratory. He eventually became the president of the New York Academy of Sciences. And I studied physics at Princeton, and my advisor was John Wheeler, who was also the advisor of Richard Feynman, although Feynman was there 20 years before I was. And I went on. I got a master's degree in physics at Vassar College. And my undergraduate thesis and my master's thesis were on extensions of Wheeler-Feynman electrodynamics. So I'm really familiar with their work. And I went to American University starting in the fall of 1970 to earn a PhD in physics. And I was taking a course called Advanced Quantum Mechanics. And the first homework assignment that we had done was handed back in October of 1970. And I got, my recollection is I got a 93 on that assignment, which is a pretty good grade. But I was really troubled because I hadn't understood a thing that I had done in order to fill out that assignment. There was a tremendous amount of formal manipulation of equations. And I learned how to do that without understanding the underlying physics. And so I decided that because I didn't understand quantum mechanics, I could never get a PhD in physics, and I left physics and I went into computer science. But I can trace it to a single night sitting in a classroom in Washington, D.C. I've been a visiting professor here since 2001. I come every year. Love to do it. It's a wonderful gig. All right, what motivates quantum computing? Well, it could, because it's there. I mean, it's possible to do it, so people will do it. But it's been estimated that by the year 2040, there will not be enough power generated on Earth to run all the computers of present architectures that we're going to need. Why? Cell phones are getting more and more and more powerful. Cell phones are spreading through the world. Supercomputers are getting more powerful. More energy every day is required to power computers. So what can we do about it? Well, we can generate more power, but that hurts the environment. We haven't figured out how nice, environmentally safe ways to generate power. We could do less computing. I know none of you are going to accept that. So the only answer is that we have to compute better. That is, new devices that are going to be able to do more computation using less power. And so ultimately, and I'm sure you realize this, but computing is not performed in the abstract. Computing is always performed by physical things, physical objects. We always want smaller, faster, and more capable computers. So we're packaging more and more physical objects, transistors, into less and less and less space. And eventually, this is going to have to stop because we can't make stable features of a semiconductor less than a certain width. In addition, there is heat dissipation. The more stuff that you pack into a smaller space, the more power is required in order to power these computers, and they are wasteful in the sense that energy is converted to heat, and they can just melt themselves. And so some change has to be required. And as things get smaller and smaller, the only way to explain their behavior is through this indeed bizarre and counterintuitive thing called quantum mechanics. So classical physics deals with objects on a macroscopic scale. You know that if I made the mistake of tossing this laser pointer in the air, it would fall. Physicists could easily predict how long it would take to fall. They might have to know the density of the air in the room, etc. They can do that. Classical physics, which has been known since a little past Newton, would be sufficient to do that. So today we compute with fairly large objects. And when I say fairly large, it means the number of atoms in them is very large. Gears, for example, in a calculator, or transistors. Classical physics is sufficient to describe the behavior of these things. Quantum mechanics, though, deals with objects on an atomic or subatomic scale, individual electrons, quarks, things like that. If we're going to compute with tiny objects, like electrons or photons, quantum mechanics is essential to explain their behavior. Classical physics just does not work at all. So the problem is, Richard Feynman famously said, nobody understands quantum mechanics. And in fact, he got the Nobel Prize for his work in quantum electrodynamics. So if anybody should have understood quantum mechanics, it would be Richard Feynman. Unfortunately, he said that after I dropped out of the American University PhD program. If I had known that nobody understood quantum mechanics, I wouldn't have faulted myself for not understanding quantum mechanics. But it's still true today. So an abacus, this is a fairly large one, has physical beads. So in order to compute, you move beads around. And then you take a look at the beads to see where they are, and you read out your answer. Now, how do you take a look at the beads? If the room were absolutely pitch black, you wouldn't be able to tell the answer. So you shine light. I can even see the reflection of the bulbs on the ceiling there. You shine light on the abacus, and you can read the abacus. And the fortunate thing is that shining light on it doesn't cause the beads to move. Because if they moved when you turn on the lights, then it would change the answer. Okay, so as long as they're big, shining light on them doesn't do anything. An adding machine has gears. That's a real old one. You turn things, and we understand how gears work. It's classical mechanics. This was the first transistor made in 1947. It's a photo from Bell Labs. And Bardeen, Bratton, and Shockley won the Nobel Prize in 1956 for the development of the transistor. But this is a big old ugly thing. And now there are a huge number of them in your cell phone. And this thing itself, that wouldn't even fit in a cell phone. It's too thick for that. I was actually born the same year as the transistor, and I've followed the parallel path to as the transistor did. So here's a current. This is the most powerful mainframe computer that's commercially available. It's the IBM Z14. It has 8 terabytes of RAM. I thought I had a big computer. I just got a new one at CMU. It has 128 gigabytes of RAM. This has 8 terabytes of RAM. This can perform 850 million encrypted transactions per day. So this is one of the reasons banks like these things. And it uses 14 nanometer technology. I'll explain that in a minute. But it has transistors, circuits, boards, and cables. These are all physical things, which we can understand by classical physics. Okay. So this is Moore's law. It's not a law of physics. It's just an observation as to how civilization has progressed. And that's Gordon Moore. He eventually became CEO of Intel. Still alive. His observation was the density of transistors that we can put on chips was doubling about every 2 years. And that the observation was first made in the 1960s, and it's held true till today. That's many, many decades. So that's anything that doubles in a constant time is exponential growth. And what this is showing is over time, various machines, and this isn't exactly density, but it's the number of transistors per chip. And the chips haven't been getting particularly bigger. And so you can see it's gone all the way up here, and there's that IBM Z14 that I just showed you. And the question is, how far can we go with this? The Apple A12X, that's the board for an iPad Pro, the current iPad Pro, has 10 billion transistors on there. When I started working for IBM after college, it was a big effort to get 3 transistors on a chip. Now we have 10 billion. Okay, that's what exponential growth will do for you. The features on the Apple A12X are only 7 nanometers wide. So a feature is, in particular, you see this gully here? That's the gully through which the electrons move on the chip. These features are 7 nanometers apart. That allows about 80 million transistors per square millimeter, if you want, at least 80 million features. Okay. Well, there's a little problem here. And the problem is, here's a silicon atom. Chips are made of silicon. Silicon, fortunately, is one of the most abundant elements on the Earth. We're never going to run out of silicon to make computers. This is not exactly to scale. This is 0.2 nanometers wide. Here's what 7 nanometers worth of silicon atoms, only 35 of them. And so if you stretch these silicon atoms between here and here, there'll only be 35 of them. And so if you're trying to get smaller and smaller, smaller than 7 nanometers, all of a sudden you're entering the quantum domain where you have to use quantum mechanics to explain the behavior of these things. And quantum mechanics predicts some very strange things. One of the strange things is that if a silicon, it's probably not true of a silicon atom, but if there's an electron here, it might very well be found the next second over here, even through what you would think was an impenetrable barrier. That's a phenomenon called quantum tunneling, which means that you can't keep small particles in place without a tremendous amount of work. And you have to use that work in order to build quantum computers. So here's the possible future of Moore's Law. I took that graph from the other slide and extended it out. Now, we can't keep making those features smaller and smaller. You're never going to make them as small as an atom, for example. So the best predictions are that we might get down to 2 nanometers. After that, forget that technology. We have to do something else. So if we use transistors that are the size of a molecule, we can keep Moore's law going. When that ends, if we make them the size of an atom, then we can keep Moore's law going. After that, nobody has any predictions as to where that's going to be. But that's out in the year 2040, and that will solve the problem that we don't have enough energy on Earth to run all the computers, if quantum computers are even possible. Now, you're going to hear, and you're going to believe by the end of tonight, that quantum mechanics seems very weird. However, I put it to you that ordinary phenomena that you're familiar with are tremendously weird, too, like gravitation. You know that if I drop this, it's going to fall. Why does it fall? You're going to say, oh, the Earth attracts it. Why do two inert masses attract each other? We don't really know that. We can predict exactly what the trajectory of this thing is as it falls, but we don't really know why it falls. Magnetism looks really weird, right? You take a magnet and you hold it over something iron and it jumps off the table to the magnet. Why? You're going to say because the magnet attracts it. Why does the magnet attract it? We can predict exactly what the forces are, but we don't know why the magnet attracts it really. Okay? So in classical physics, here's Mr. Newton. I think it's really strange that the apple that's hitting him on the head has already been eaten by something. I never got that, okay? So Newton was concerned about why masses attract each other, but he was careful enough not to produce an explanation because we don't really have one. He did formulate the law of gravitation, which is that the force between the apple and the Earth is proportional to their product of their masses and is inversely proportional to the square of the distance between the apple and the center of the Earth. That Newton's law of gravitation held strong until the early 1900s, till Einstein. But Newton never explained why masses attract one another. But you accept it because you experience it every day. You drop something every day. You have to walk up a hill every day, and you're experiencing, you have to work against gravity. It's very familiar to you. The quantum phenomena we're going to talk about are not familiar to you. So Einstein comes along and tries to explain why things attract each other. So here's his explanation. Masses and energy cause space-time to curve, whatever that means. Gravity is a consequence of this curvature. So here's Einstein, and he's massive, and he's caused space-time to curve. And you can easily see that something here is going to fall down there, right? It's lower potential or something. And so this supposedly explains why masses attract each other, because each one curves space, and they follow what physicists will call geodesics in space-time. That's a predictive theory. It's not an explanatory theory. It doesn't explain why space-time curves. It just says, oh, it does, and we can measure that. Okay? So, now we'll get into a little quantum mechanics. It's a very famous experiment performed by Thomas Young in 1801. It's the double slit experiment. So here I have a light source, a light bulb. Of course, there were no light bulbs in 1801, but let's say a lot of candles. A lot of candles producing white light. And we create a metal sheet that has two slits in it. Two slits. You can't see them. All you're seeing is on the edge of the sheet. Now you would predict that the light, which is emanating from this source, is going to cover this sheet, but it can't get through unless there's a hole there. And so it's going to go through here, and we're going to get a spot up there. And it goes through there, and we're going to get a spot up there. And this is an easy experiment to do. You can do it at home. You have lights. You have knives. You can create these things. And that would be the expected pattern. But instead, this is the actual pattern. It's referred to as a diffraction pattern. And instead of getting two spots, you get many, many, many spots, but you also get dark areas where no light shows up. And the most amazing thing to me about this is the brightest spot, this one, is exactly opposite the center of the space between the slits where no light can get through there. Okay, so how do we explain this? Well, classical physicists were able to. They said, well, light's a wave. And so waves, as you know, can interfere with one another. If you go to a lake and you disturb the lake in two different places, as the waves approach each other, they'll cancel each other out in the middle. And so these aren't water waves, they're some other kind of wave, which Young didn't know because electromagnetism hadn't been explained at that time yet. But that pattern was known very, very early in 1801, and it was thought to have been explained. Okay? Well, then Einstein comes along, and this is the work that won him the Nobel Prize in 1921. For work he did in 1905, or at least published in 1905. And this is his explanation of the photoelectric effect, which throws the wave theory all to hell. So the photoelectric effect was well known to physicists. If you shine light on a metal, electrons are ejected from the metal. We now understand the reason that occurs is that the atoms of the metal are excited, they absorb energy, and electrons are able to break the potential barrier between them and the nucleus, and they leave the metal. Okay, this was well known. And so the expectation would be, if you use more light, you're going to get more electrons. So instead of one candle, I have 10,000 candles. You would think you're certainly going to get more electrons with 10,000 candles than with one candle. But the answer is that you don't. Whether electrons get ejected or not doesn't depend on how much light is being shined on the metal. It's what is the frequency of the light? That is, what color is the light? And this is amazing. Okay, so Einstein's explanation was that light, as opposed to waves, which everybody thought it was, And you can almost prove that it's waves, but you can also prove that it's discrete particles called photons. And so whether an electron is ejected depends on the energy of the photons, which in turn depends on the frequency of the light. So yellow light, no electrons. No matter how much, you can turn this up, you can have a massive searchlight of yellow, and you shine it at the metal, and you wait 10 years, and no electrons are going to come out. On the other hand, if you take a little laser of purple light, much less intense than a searchlight, then electrons come out in profusion. And this cannot be explained by any wave theory. And so the current thinking is that electrons, photons, all of these particles behave both as particles, that is, discrete little packets, and as a wave. Okay. Now, gets a little more weird. So after these discoveries by Einstein and his publications, Bohr and Heisenberg in 1925, both Nobel Prize winners, came up with an explanation about this wave behavior. They said, you know, the particle looks like it's in one place at one time, but really there's a probability that you might find it anywhere in the universe, but that probability is really pretty well concentrated near where you think it is. So what they said was there's a probability function here. So if you think that the electron is here, that has the highest probability, but there's some probability that it's over there, and there's some lower probability that it's over there, and there's a really tiny probability that it's over there. So it's kind of spread out. It's not a discrete little point, but it's a spread of probability that moves with it as it moves through the universe. And when you actually see it, then this wave structure disappears, and it collapses into a single point, which is the place at which you observed the particle. That was their explanation. And then Schrödinger came along a year later, read their paper, and he said, aha, I can produce an equation that will show what the development of this wave function is in time. And so he wrote this differential equation that won him the Nobel Prize. It was one of the greatest discoveries in physics ever. Okay, now, I'm going to get to some stuff that's a little bit more relevant for quantum computing. This device is the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. It's very old. Very old. It's before Einstein. Mach is the son of Ernst Mach, not the Ernst Mach himself. So these were physicists in the late 1800s. And they made this device. And the device, they didn't know about photons, but light. Where you see red, it means light is being shined in there. And this thing here is a beam splitter. Those are easy to make. Half-silvered mirrors are beam splitters, right? You can make a mirror that you only partially, some light is reflected from and some light goes through, right? And so let's make a beam splitter that splits the photons exactly in half. So of the ones that come in, half go this way and half go this way. These are just ordinary mirrors that have 100% reflectivity. So photons come here, they get split, then half of them go this way, and half of them go this way, and we have another beam splitter in there. And with this beam splitter, you would think that of the ones that come in here, half would go there and half would go there, and the ones that come in here, half would go there and half would go there. So, you know, it should be 50-50. Well, what really happens is they all go there. None of them go there. That's really strange. Now, if you want to do this at home, you have to be real careful. The device must be very precise, and the distances between the beam splitters and the mirrors has to be exactly right. But if you get it exactly right, then you can cause, and the reason it's called an interferometer is if you treat these things as waves, what happens is there's destructive interference between the two paths that causes nothing to come out there. Now, there are two things that are shocking about this. Aside from the very behavior itself, one thing that's really shocking to me, well, first of all, this device was invented in 1892 before there were even photons known. But this is the shocker. If we put a barrier here so that none of these photons can get to the mirror, now what happens? Now you get 25%, 25%, because 50% go there, 50% get absorbed, and then everything behaves normally. And it behaves normally because there's no destructive interference because there isn't a second path there. Okay, so I've given you this fakey explanation in terms of waves. I talk about interference between the waves. Now, the real shocker is if I send photons one at a time through the device, exactly the same thing happens. If I send one photon through, and it's easy to do that, send one photon through, it's not coming out there. Well, what did it interfere with? If there were no other photons in the vicinity, what did it interfere with? It interfered with itself. Its own wave function interfered with its own wave function. It's extremely strange behavior. Okay? Now, quantization. Many physical quantities come in discrete packages. Some people think everything comes in discrete packages. There are even theories that space is quantized. You can't move continuously through space, but you're hopping from one cube to another. We don't know whether that's true or not. Nobody's observed that. But light energy exists as individual photons. Electrical charge comes in discrete units. It gets as small as the charge on an electron. You can't cut an electron in half. You can't get half a charge. The problem is that discrete packages like photons, electrons, these really tiny things, they don't always behave like particles confined to a small space because of the Bohr-Heisenberg explanation of this spread out wave function. Okay? So here's a quantization example. A coin, I say, can be in one of two states. This happens to be an American coin. That's a head, and that's a tail. The bird actually has a tail. The head of Washington actually has a head. Okay, heads and tails. So it's in two states, right? When I flip the coin, it's either going to come up heads or tails, and we're going to ignore the possibility that it might land on its edge. Okay? It's difficult to do it, but if you flip a coin a million times, it might actually happen once. So these are going to be idealized coins that have no thickness. Okay? Now, when you observe the coin, you shine some light on it, and you look at it, oh, that's a head. That's very easy, and shining light on it doesn't cause the coin to flip up and change its state. Okay? Now, I can use the coins to represent a bit string, right? So if I say that tails is T and heads is H, and I associate a 0 with tails and a 1 with heads, then I've just represented this binary string, which happens to be the number 77 in decimal. So what I can do now is I could create, in a sense, registers, computer registers, based on these things that have two states, either heads or tails. So they perfectly mirror binary numbers, right? Fine. Now I ask you this question. What is the state of that coin? Is it a head? No. You see a head flow around once in a while. Is it a tail? No. It's both. Because we don't know when that's spinning, when it's finally observed, and the way you observe this coin is not by shining light on it, by flicking it, so to cause it to fall. It will fall either heads or tails. But right now, it's representing both heads and tails. And that's referred to as superposition. There are two states, heads and tails. It's not in either one of them. It's in a sense in both of them because either one could be the outcome of an observation. Okay? Now, a qubit is an abbreviation for a quantum bit. It is a bit represented by a quantum object. Okay? So here's an example of a qubit. An electron is a qubit. Because electron has spin up or spin down. When you don't know which it is until you observe the electron. You measure it, and you're going to get either pointing up or pointing down. Exactly the same thing as a coin. When the electron is not being observed, it's in both states at the same time. But when you observe it, it has to be in one or the other. You can't observe it in both. So it's in a superposition of states until it's measured. Here's another qubit. Photon can have one of two polarizations. If you have polarized sunglasses, you know about polarization. You take two polarization sunglasses and you turn one 90 degrees to the other and no light comes through at all. Because one of them it only allows photons that have vertical polarization through. The other one won't allow ones with vertical polarization through. Okay? So the photon is in a superposition of states until it's measured, until you measure its state. And here's yet another one. An atom can be in two different states, well, a simple atom, depending on electron energy levels. So here's a nucleus, and here's an electron whirling around the nucleus. This is referred to as the ground state. It's the one in which the electron is closest to the nucleus. If I pump energy into the atom at the right frequency, This is the photoelectric effect, actually. You can cause this electron to move to a different orbit farther away. There. Well, that's referred to as the ground state. This is the excited state. Until you measure the atom, you don't know which state it's in. But it's going to be in one or the other. And it could be either. You don't know. So it's a superposition of both states. So this is a qubit, is a bit that is both 0 and 1 at the same time. Whereas a classical bit can either be only 0 or only 1. Your computer programs would not work if you couldn't depend on the register to have constant values in there. Okay? Oops. All right. These are three actual qubits that have been built. These are three beryllium atoms held in place by something called an atom trap. If you use the right combination of electrical and magnetic fields, you can get the beryllium atoms to stay in one place. And then you can do things to them. And so because there are three qubits, this thing can hold eight different values simultaneously. 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, eight different possibilities. If these were classical bits, like stored with transistors or something, you could only hold one of those eight values. So you can see as the number of qubits goes up, the number of different values you can hold simultaneously goes up exponentially as powers of two. So how do you determine, how do you do this observation of the state of an electron in a nucleus? Well, this one's in a ground state. If it's in a ground state, then it's susceptible to being excited. Meaning, by sending light into it, I can cause the electron to move to another state. When it does that, it emits photons. So here's what we do. We shine a laser at this thing. It bounces the electron up into another excited state, which causes it to emit photons. That tells us it was in the ground state. We didn't know that till we observed it. Over here, if it's already in an excited state, then pumping more energy into it doesn't do any good. It's not going to go back to the ground state, and it's not going to go into any other state. So if I shine the laser on an atom, I observe it, and if it's in the excited state, nothing comes out. It's easy to tell. You just shine light on the thing. Okay? So bits versus qubits. N classical bits can represent 1 out of 2 to the n values. You're familiar with this. 8 bits, 1 byte, you get 1 of 256 values from 0 to 255. If I have 32 bits, 4 bytes, that's 1 of 4 billion values. So that was the old version 4 IP addresses, where 32 bits long, you could address any of 4 billion computers on Earth. If you had 8,192 bits, that's 1 kilobyte, then you could represent 2 to the 8,192 values, which is approximately a number 2,466 digits long. That is a really, really big number. N qubits can represent all 2 to the n values simultaneously, which means if we do manipulations of qubits, we're essentially doing a parallel computation on all possible combinations of the data. It's this like immense parallel computer. Nobody's going to build this. 300 qubits alone are enough to represent more values than there are atoms in the entire universe. So 2 to the 300th is more atoms than are in the known universe. Now, it turns out we are going to build computers that have more qubits than that, but for a special reason I'll tell you later. Okay, so here's a Moore's law of qubits. The size in qubits of quantum computers has been doubling every year. Right now it's quite small. It's in like two digits. But eventually it's going to get bigger because of this law. Large numbers of qubits are actually needed because quantum computations, unlike classical computations, are not deterministic because of the probability interpretation. That means that when you manipulate a qubit, it doesn't necessarily always do what you want it to do. It does it with a certain probability. So you have to use error-correcting codes in order to, you repeat the experiment many times, and you take the majority or something like that. Okay? So now, if you've believed all that stuff, then you're going to get off the train now, because you're not going to believe this. And that's the concept of entanglement. So what we do is when we have a quantum system which consists of more than one particle, we attempt to write a function that describes the state of the entire system, not just this particle and this particle, but how does the entire system behave? It sometimes happens, and it actually happens very frequently, that it's impossible to describe the states of two particles separately because the state of this one depends on the state of that one. You might understand that maybe because they're close to one another and they're sort of influencing each other. But it's not really that. If we can only describe the state of the combined set of particles, they act as a single quantum system and we refer to them as being entangled with one another. What does that mean? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take two coins and I'm going to put them in opposite spin states. All right, I'm going to spin one this way, I'm going to spin the other one the other way. Now, I still don't know whether that's going to be a head or that's going to be a tail. I don't know what, because they haven't been observed yet. They haven't been knocked over, and they haven't fallen. Either one of the coins, you would think, could go heads or tails. That's what you'd think if you were a classical thinker. So now I'm going to take these two coins, I'm going to separate them. Okay? Now, I'll tell you later how far you can separate them. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to measure that coin. I'm going to determine what state it's in. Okay? It's heads. That one immediately falls tails. If that one's heads, that one has to be tails. And now the amazing thing is this distance between them, experiments have been, no, it's not done with coins actually. It's done with photons. But the maximum distance between which this phenomenon has been observed on Earth is 1,200 kilometers. You can separate them by 1,200 kilometers, and when you measure this one, that one instantly falls into the opposite state. Now, don't ask me why. Don't ask anybody why. It doesn't matter why. It just behaves that way. In the same way that you can't tell me why this thing is going to fall when I drop it. It just does, and we know that it does. So you got to believe in entanglement. Now, entanglement is critical because if I have a bunch of qubits that are supposed to represent a number, when I want to add one to the number, there has to be some interaction among the different qubits. Otherwise, they're all just separate individual bits.
How can you separate two photons 1,200 kilometers away?
Yeah. Why not? Photons are coming from the sun all the time. It's 8 million miles.
Yeah, but you still identified that?
I'll show you one of the last slides in the talk. I'll show you how they do that. Okay? Now, so to represent all 2 to the n values in a single register that can be operated on as a unit, the qubits must all be entangled. And one expert said that without entanglement, a quantum computer would be a very expensive classical computer. Because you're doing all this work to represent these bits, and if you don't have entanglement, you're getting no benefit from quantum superposition. Each qubit would be operated on separately instead of all together, and you wouldn't get the 2 to the n parallelism. Okay, so you have to entangle the qubits. Okay, this article appeared earlier in 2018. Chinese physicists set new quantum entanglement record at 18 qubits. A team of Chinese scientists demonstrated the world's first 18-qubit entanglement. Okay, so it's a lot of work. It's not so tough to entangle two objects. Entangling more than 18 hasn't been done yet. But I have faith we're going to be able to entangle more of them. Okay, now, what do you do with these qubits once you have them? The way you manipulate them is with something called quantum gates, which are analogous to but not the same as classical gates. So a classical gate in a computer is a circuit. And the idea here is this is an AND gate. It takes two inputs, two bits, X and Y, and it outputs the AND of them, meaning if both of them are 1, that's a 1. If either of them is a 0, that's a 0. And these are implemented with physical things. They're implemented with transistors, typically. So here are 2 transistors. We apply a voltage here. And if there's a voltage here, voltages have to be both here and here in order to cause output to occur there. So it's simple. Okay, it's a physical thing. And we can understand these classically. Quantum gates are not circuits. You can't pass photons, for example, through copper. It's just copper is opaque to light. It won't go through there. So quantum gates, and I put this in quotes because they act like classical gates, but they're not really. They are operations that are performed on qubits. They're not circuits, but they're protocols. And the protocol might be shine a light of this frequency for this amount of time on this qubit. Shine that light at a different time, different frequency, etc. Okay? A Hadamard gate. One of the most important, is equivalent to spinning a coin. It takes something that's in a known state and puts it in a superposition of two states. Very, very easy to do that. So the circuit model of quantum computing is your input is represented in n qubits. Then you have this thing here, which is an algorithm. The algorithm is a whole bunch of these gates, but the gates are just processes. It's things that you do to the qubits. And then you observe each qubit, and you get an output. You get it as one or a zero from each qubit. Very simple. Okay? But there are some problems. And you can't use standard programming languages for this. And one of the reasons is something called the no-cloning theorem. If I have a qubit in a given state, I don't know what its state is, of course, because it's a superposition of states. I can't copy a qubit, because in order to copy it, I'd have to observe it. And if I observed it, it would drop into a single state, and it wouldn't be a superposition anymore. So it's impossible to clone qubits. You can't copy them. If you can't copy them, because you destroy the superposition when you do that, you can't have this simple programming statement. If you had a quantum language, you could never have set x equal to y, because you can't make a copy of y and put it in x. So, you know, forget Python. It's not going to work for quantum computers. We need new programming languages and new constructs. So this is a diagram from IBM. IBM actually has a quantum computer. You can use it for free. There's a website that you go to. You just sign up. Tell them who you are, and you can program their quantum computer. They'll run your little program, and they'll tell you what the output was. And so here's a problem, and you describe it by drawing an idealized circuit, that is, idealized gates. Each of these colored squares and circles is a different type of quantum gate. Then there's a compiler that takes your input and rearranges it so that it will work properly on the actual quantum computer that IBM has. You don't need to know the details of the architecture, just like a regular programming language. When you're programming in C, you don't have to know what the architecture of the computer that you're running is, right? The compiler's job is to take account of the particular computer that you're running on and what its machine language is. Well, this thing has a machine language in the sense that there are certain processes it's able to perform and other processes it can't perform. And so the compiler rearranges your gate set. And this is really a lot of fun to play with. And let's do some playing here.
You're sure that it's not a simulation?
I'm sure. Okay. He of little faith. Okay. So here is the quantum computer. It has a limited number of qubits. Okay? So there are 5 qubits here. And the 5 qubits all start out, you can't really read that, but they all start out in state 0. Okay? It's the same thing. When you run a computer program, the registers are initialized to 0, right? And you do everything from there. So they're initialized to 0. And if you want to create a quantum algorithm, you can grab a Hadamard gate and you stick that there. Okay? And then you can take a C-naught gate. Whoops. See, you can't. It says you can't drop the gate there. It's like your compiler tells you that there's a programming error in your program. So I'll throw a Hadamard gate here, and I'll throw this gate here. I'm allowed to do that. Oops, I can't move it, but I can put it there. Okay? And I can control the length of this thing, etc. And you just keep moving these things around. And of course, if you want to know what they do, there's an explanation of all the different gates. And the documentation comes along with the system, right? And so you do that, and you can save it or you can run it. And IBM will run it for you. It's very cute. Okay? So, what can quantum computers do? What have they done so far? Well, there's a big difference between theory and practice in quantum computing. There have been quantum algorithms known before anybody ever actually built a quantum computer. And so this algorithm is from the mid-1990s. This is Shor's algorithm. Given a d-digit integer n, find its prime factor. So there's an example of a pretty long number. And those are the unique two integers which, when multiplied together, give that number. If you used pencil and paper and you used the algorithm that you learned in high school for longhand multiplication, For that number, it would take you well over 100 years to find those two factors, but you would eventually do it. Classically, the best algorithm currently known takes about 2 to the cube root of d operations. You probably don't have day-to-day familiarity with the function 2 to the cube root of d. Okay? Shor's quantum algorithm requires only d cubed operations. And it turns out if d is greater than or equal to 2, which is not tough, then this number is always greater than what Shor's algorithm requires. These are those two functions plotted on a log plot. So even though this is getting big fast, in absolute terms, it's getting bigger much faster if this were a linear scale instead of a log scale. Now, Shor's algorithm is thought to be incredibly important because if you can run this fast, you can break RSA encryption, which depends on the difficulty of factoring numbers. So basically, all kinds of algorithms that are currently used in the world would be cracked if there were big enough quantum computers. Here's another one, Grover's algorithm. Given a program that computes f of x, and this is a black box program, you're not allowed to go look inside to see what it does. You send in a value, and a value comes out. You send in x, and f of x comes out. The question is, and I'm going to tell you, that there's one value of x that produces the answer 1, and every other value of x produces 0. Now you've got to find x. There's no better way known classically than to try every possible value. Okay? Because you know nothing about the structure of the function. It could be an arbitrary mapping. Okay? Finding this function is the equivalent of database search. It is given an unordered table of n elements, see if a particular value is in the table. And there's no better way to do that than to start at the top and keep going all the way down, because it could be anywhere. If the table were ordered, you'd do binary search or something like that. But an unordered table, you don't have the benefit of any structure. Classically, you have to take n lookups. Grover's quantum algorithm takes only the square root of n lookups. And this is showing these two, again, plotted on a log plot. This is much, much faster. You can do things in days with Grover's algorithm that would take more than the age of the universe with the classical algorithm. And the amazing thing, you computer science theorists out there, Grover's algorithm is optimal. You cannot achieve an exponential speed-up in search, in unordered search. You can achieve an exponential speed-up in factoring. That is, if you could build the quantum computer. So, there are some problems, though. And one problem is that qubits can lose state very quickly because of outside noise. So, random particles that are coming from space go and they essentially cause an observation to occur on a qubit. They cause it to drop into a unique state instead of and lose the superposition. They can lose entanglement the same way. Once you lose one qubit of an entangled pair, as soon as you observe one, all the others collapse into some particular state. You lose the entanglement. IBM's qubits, even though they're in a very fancy machine, only last about 100 microseconds. So that means that you got to get your computation done before the expected decay time. Okay? They also require a very cold and radiation-free environment, because what's radiation? Electromagnetic waves are going to cause observation. And quantum computation is errorful because there's only a certain probability of an outcome. You can make it pretty high, but it's not 100%. And so what you have to do essentially is redundant calculation, comparing the outputs to see which value it is that you think is the correct value. And that requires larger numbers of qubits than are technically needed to do the computation. So you need lots and lots of them. So here is what a quantum computer today looks like. It's cooled to 0.015 Kelvin. Well, you know, 0 Kelvin is -273.15 Celsius. Liquid nitrogen, which is pretty cold stuff, only gets you down to 196 below. Liquid helium only gets you down to -270. And you have to get down below the temperature of liquid helium. So this is not particularly easy. Also, you have to shield this thing so the Earth's magnetic field is not able to penetrate, and you get 50,000 times less magnetic field in a quantum computer than you do in this room, for example. And the atmospheric pressure is 10 billion times lower than atmospheric. Why? Because you don't want air molecules bouncing around and interfering with your qubits. Okay? They even have a low vibration floor. Why? Because if you vibrate things, you can knock electrons out of them. Okay? So the future of quantum computing is unknown. There are people out there who will say it's never going to work, and there are people who are going to say its potential is unlimited and will be for the benefit of mankind. If we can build quantum computers, it will revolutionize AI, cryptography, supercomputing, almost any other thing that you can imagine that computers do. Right now, the VC investments are still pretty small. If you start a quantum computing company, they'll say, well, okay, here's a single-digit $1 million. Some companies, D-Wave is the biggest promoter of quantum computing. They've raised over $100 million already. Some companies, like Intel and IBM, are very heavily invested. So IBM already, I showed you the Z14, which is the most powerful commercial computer available. They want to keep Moore's Law going. They want to keep making more and more and more powerful computers, and they know they can't do it by simply reducing the distance between features on a silicon chip. So progress is being made every week. There are tremendous numbers of articles. If you just type quantum computing, don't let Google fill in the query. Say quantum computing and go to Google News and just keep every day more and more articles. So here's the answer to your question about creating the photons. Okay? So this was February, this was 2 days ago. It's a good thing that I saw this, otherwise I might not have been able to answer your question. Entangling photons of different colors. Researchers develop a novel chip-based device for quantum communication. So here's the problem. Optical components that store and process quantum information, like qubits, for example, require visible light photons to operate. However, only near-infrared photons with wavelengths about 10 times longer can transport information over optical fibers. Visible light is not used in optical fibers because glass is too absorbent of visible light. It doesn't absorb infrared. And so there are frequencies lower than the frequencies of visible light. But you can't use those for qubits. So the question is, if you created two photons that were entangled, you could keep one, but you couldn't send the other one. Or you could send one, but you couldn't keep the other one. That's the problem that the scientists at the National Institute of Science and Technology solved, and here's what they did. This is a microscopic device. This is really tiny, okay? It's shown large here. And so what happens is there's a pump laser that pumps purple light in here, and this starts to go around. Light starts to go around the ring resonator, and it creates entangled pairs of photons. This red one is one color. This blue one is a different color. This blue one can be used in telecommunication. The red one is a visible light photon that can be used as a qubit. And so they're entangled with one another. And no matter how far away this goes down the optical fiber, when the polarization of this photon is observed, that one will instantly collapse into another state, to the opposite state. So that's the kind of stuff that you have to do to build quantum computers and to transport the data elsewhere. Okay, well, even though we started a little late, we finished on time. And I thought in advance that I would have about a, everything's probabilistic anyway, that I would have about a 70% chance of achieving the objective. But what I'm really proud of is there was absolutely no quantum notation used here. And I actually found quantum bracket notation to be really off-putting, and I still do. I still hate reading papers that use Dirac's notation. And so I vowed not to do it here, and I was able to achieve that. Are there any questions that you think I might be able to answer?